listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. The kid is currently, filming everything, literally everything. The entirety of Hollywood rests on his shoulders. He's basically the Atlas of the American entertainment industry. And we're grateful for his service to his country. But fortunately, that means that I get today's guest all to myself, Professor Peter Turchin, who has written a bunch of amazing books. David Sloan Wilson was good enough to put us in touch with him. And his latest book, Ultra Society, How 10,000 Years of War Made Humans the Greatest Cooperators on Earth. And there are amazing chapters in there, such as God Made Men, But Sam Colt Made Them Equal, and The Rise of God Kings, The Iron Law of Oligarchy. Oh boy, is this my kind of book. And boy, oh boy, do I wish that Brian Callen was here to experience it, because if there's anything that Brian likes to talk / imagine himself as, it's a God King. Professor, you're currently on sabbatical, so I'm supposed to call you Peter, which is going to be very unnatural for me. But you're also in Toulouse, is that correct?
That's right. I'm in this wonderful city.
And how's the weather there in the sunny south of France?
It's very nice. It's been sunny today, around 65 degrees. So perfect weather. It actually doesn't feel like fall.
Well, that is always the goal. Southern California, we aim for a-seasonality. This book really draws off of, even the title, it seems to be really a development of the thinking from your previous book, War and Peace and War. Does that seem fair?
Yes. Essentially, ever since I switched from being a biologist to being a social scientist, the central question that has driven my research was trying to understand how did our wonderful, large-scale, complex societies evolved.
Right, because, as you say in the first chapter of the book, it's so incredibly unusual, the ability to form social organizations that are so dynamic, of such variable size, that can form, regroup, break up, and be on such a tremendous scale, right? These sort of ultra societies.
Yes. In fact, we are the champion cooperators on this earth. Our closest competitors are ants. But ants, first of all, can cooperate in smaller societies, maybe a few million individuals, whereas some of our human societies are hundreds of millions, even a billion people. And also, ants cooperate with close genetic relatives. Mm-hmm. Humans are unique because we can cooperate with individuals that are not genetically related to us.
Right. And not only that, of course, ants, there are only a certain number of roles, right? You have a queen, a drone, workers, but there aren't, you can't have the tremendous diversity of societal roles that you find in human societies.
Yes, some ants, like leaf cutter ants, they have multiple roles, actually a couple dozen different types of workers. They have fairly extensive division of labor, but it's nothing like thousands of professions that modern societies need to survive and operate.
Yeah, and I think just so that our listeners fully appreciate how brilliant you are and how ambitious your work is, I think it's important that we start by talking about cleodynamics and what exactly that is. So do you mind giving us a little bit of an overview of what that is?
Sure. Cleodynamics is compounded from two words. Cleo is the muse of history, so that sort of indicates that we are talking about history. And dynamics is the science of change. So cleodynamics is basically doing history as science, as hard science as physics or biology. We use mathematical models to translate verbal theories into well-defined mathematical models, and then we use those models to make predictions, which we can then test with data, historical data and archaeological data. So it's a very, very hard-nosed scientific approach treating history just like any kind of natural or social science.
Yeah, and that's a pretty ambitious effort. And in fact, there's a Wired article about your work from 2013 in which they compare you to Harry Seldon from Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
Yeah, guilty as charged. In fact, in my previous popular book, War and Peace and War, I actually start by talking about Asimov's Foundation series.
Right, and so what exactly was Harry Seldon trying to do? What did he do?
So Asimov wrote that book before we had what some people call the Chaos Revolution. Back in the 1970s, mathematicians and physicists who were studying complex systems realized that they are actually so complex they cannot be predicted for any long periods in the future. But when Asimov wrote his book, he didn't know this result. And so in his Foundation series, Harry Seldon, a very talented mathematician, he actually creates a science of history, which he calls psychohistory, and he manages to predict the development of the galactic empire hundreds of years in the future. So we now know that's not possible. The other thing that psychohistory is different from cleodynamics is that Asimov was, by training, he was an organic chemist. Well, biochemist, actually. And so he was imagining societies as a huge number of molecules slashing together. So people are like molecules, and therefore he would imagine that by studying how molecules interact with each other, you know, the different types of chemical reactions, you could actually deduce the laws of history. Now, it turns out that human societies are not really bags of sloshing people. They have a lot of internal structure. There are groups of groups of groups. Then there are all kinds of cultural elements, such as social norms and institutions. So all those features of human societies make them very different from chemical, you know, test tubes, essentially. So the approach that cleodynamics takes is much, much more sociological than psychological.
Yeah, and I mean, isn't that always the thing, to find the right analogy and the right model? I mean, Nassim Nicholas Taleb has talked about how routinely we think of financial systems as being essentially, you know, like a car or something like that, where, you know, it's a physical object and you want to avoid stress, as opposed to being biological systems where stress makes them stronger. And so, again, like, the wrong analogy can lead you so far astray, and it seems like that was the problem with Asimov's thinking, is that, you know, he was thinking of human society biochemically, and you're saying, no, we need to think of it more sociologically.
Yes, more sociologically, and also we have to employ the new insights from the science of complexity. Mm-hmm. So Taleb's result about black swans also follows from those new developments that we have realized really in the last 20 or 30 years, the so-called fat tails, that very, very extreme events are not quite as unusual as one might think, all right? And those types of very extreme events, which are not so improbable, they arise as a result of interactions within complex systems. So in many ways, the black swans and the types of things we do in cleodynamics are actually quite closely related. However, I should say that I don't quite agree with Taleb in his somewhat pessimistic view of the possibility of science of history. He focuses too much on those unusual events, and he tends to deny that it is possible to do some predictions, and it is possible to do useful science about figuring out how our societies actually operate.
But I mean, that's also part of Taleb's deal, right? His social role is to be the curmudgeon and to say that, you guys think you know so much, but you know nothing. And I mean, I think he's been incredibly valuable in that role, but you could hardly expect him to suddenly be incredibly positive about something and be like, yeah, we can know everything.
Yeah, right. He's quite very useful in telling us that you cannot know. You don't think you know as much as you do.
Right.
However, he tends to go overboard in the other direction.
Yeah.
And he tends to claim that you know too little, and actually it's quite possible to generate the kind of knowledge it's possible to generate.
Yeah, he's like the nihilist in The Big Lebowski. You know nothing, Lebowski. So, you know, but so to get back to, you know, Ultra Society, I mean, so it's this incredible, you know, this incredible ability that humans have, right? And a lot of this is also meshes very nicely, and it's, you know, perhaps not surprising that your own original work was in biology, with sort of this, there has been really this renaissance in the idea of, you know, the abilities of humans to organize. We've realized that we have much more in common with ants, thanks to people like E.O. Wilson and then David Sloan Wilson, than perhaps we might have realized 50 years ago.
Yes. So basically, yes, I was trained as a biologist, and what I do, I deploy the mathematical apparatus, essentially, to study human societies just as we have studied populations of animals and plants. So to return back to the outer society, so outer society, it's those I refer to are huge societies of many millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people that are quite well organized and very have complex structure, which allows them to actually function and to produce all kinds of public goods. All right. So the big question is, how could such societies have arisen in the evolutionary process? And the only way to figure it out is to understand that all our societies are based on cooperation. You take cooperation out and the society falls apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think the you know, chapter one, I mean, does such a good job of comparing, you know, some of these great works from, you know, Göbekli Tepe, which I previously did not know about, which I guess is the oldest monumental site on the planet.
That's right. Known to us.
Yeah. And, you know, you break it down. I mean, and, you know, you're again, just in case Nassim Nicholas Taleb is listening to this, you're very clear that, you know, these are estimates of how many man hours or man years were required to complete these works. But, you know, I mean, the comparisons of, say, you know, 400,000 for the pyramids as compared to 100,000 for the Colosseum, and then the truly staggering amount of cooperation it takes to make the International Space Station.
Yeah, so basically what I do, in that first chapter, I'm going back. I start with the International Space Station. I'm a space buff myself, so I like science fiction. And so to me, International Space Station is a wonderful object, a cathedral in the sky, so to speak. And so you look at that, and that's an incredible feat of human engineering, which is estimated like 3 million people years were invested in getting this cathedral in the sky to fly. And so I use the most impressive structures, such as the International Space Station, go back in time, and we go look at the cathedrals, and the pyramids, and then we end in a place in southeastern Turkey where 11,000 years ago people built the first temple. This place is called Göbekli Tepe. And beyond that, if you look into the past, beyond 11,000 years, we see nothing. There are no structures, no monumental structures more complex than, you know, a campfire, essentially, and some temporary shelters around it, or caves. All right. So you can see that what's interesting about it is how little time we have traveled all the way from the very first monumental architecture to the space station in a mere 11,000 years.
Yeah, and the process by which this happened is, you know, what, you know, creative destruction, or as you call it, destructive creation. And, you know, specifically our capacity for culture. So do you mind dilating a little bit on that?
Yes. So basically, you know, let's go back to our analogy, looking at impressive buildings. These impressive buildings are a result of many, many people cooperating together to build something new and unusual. So the question is, we go back to cooperation. Now, cooperation, the evolution of cooperation is a huge, huge puzzle. The problem is this. In order for people to cooperate, on one hand, it's wonderful because it produces all kinds of public goods. You know, for example, roads that everybody can use, or, you know, a beautiful cathedral that people can worship at or enjoy in other ways. But in order to build such things, somebody has to spend a lot of labor, money. Sometimes people have to risk their lives to produce a public good. For example, imposing internal peace and eliminating crime means that somebody has to be out there patrolling the streets and perhaps dying sometimes. So all of those cooperation feeds, they have the same structure. They produce something that everybody can enjoy, but people have to contribute. They have to sacrifice in order to produce it. And so the traditional evolutionary theory actually had always had trouble with explaining how cooperation could evolve. Because if you look at very influential books, so for example, The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, he essentially proves that cooperation cannot evolve. Cooperation in large groups of genetically unrelated individuals cannot evolve because everybody will free ride. Everybody will want others to contribute to the public good. But nobody wants to contribute their own treasure or time or risk of death. So the big question then becomes is how do we understand? Because obviously human groups have evolved cooperation. So the question becomes, how did it happen? And really the only theory that can help us to explain this is something which has this quite a mouthful, multi-level selection theory. What it means basically, it's competition between groups. So those groups that manage somehow to get cooperation, they outcompete the groups that cannot cooperate. And that's how cooperation spreads, despite the costs that individuals have to bear to sustain it.
Yeah, and so it's really, I mean, that's the fundamental flaw in Dawkins's work, is that he only considers within-group competition and doesn't consider between-group competition.
Well, he actually considers it and he rejects it. Oh. He thinks that the only way people can get altruistic is by what is known as kin selection, so you basically help mm-hmm. your relatives. That's what ants and wasps and bees do, for example. Or reciprocal altruism, where, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. The only problem is that reciprocal altruism works only in very small groups of people, 2, 3, 5. You know, as soon as you get a larger group of people, it breaks down. So the only mechanism that can actually help us explain how cooperation in large groups evolved is between group competition. And that's actually the mechanism that Richard Dawkins still continues to reject. But the reason I think that Dawkins is wrong, obviously, is because not only because the idea of multi-level selection, of competition between groups, makes so much sense. And this idea has also been translated into mathematical models. And so we see that the mathematical models work. So not only it works at this theoretical level, this idea has actually been tested empirically. This is what I and my colleagues do in our work. Mm-hmm. We look at history and we test the idea that cooperation arises as a result of competition between human groups and whole societies. And of course, until quite recently, the most typical form this competition took was war.
Well, and we see this woven into human psychology, right? I mean, the surest way to bind the group together more tightly is to perceive some external threat, right? And politicians have understood this for a long time and tapped into it. You know, that's why Hitler burned down the Reichstag and blamed it on the communists. You know, mm-hmm. obviously the United States pulled together in many senses after 9/11 as a response to a perceived external threat. You know, the Americans after Pearl Harbor. You know, that idea of the outside threat, whether it's in the context of, you know, World War II or, you know, two competing groups on, you know, a reality TV show like Survivor, is what bonds people together. So we can see that human modality in terms of our psychology plays out again and again.
Exactly. So our evolved psychology makes it very easy for people to bunch together in groups as soon as they are threatened by some other group of humans. And so it is really this competition, this conflict between the different groups is what drives the evolution of cooperation. So over the last several hundred thousand years, humans have competed in groups against others in a variety of ways. By the way, I should mention that warfare is not the only way that groups can compete against each other. So in the modern world, for example, societies compete more by providing good quality of life for their people, all right, than by warfare. So, for example, I was raised in the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, was not conquered by the United States in the war, right? But the Soviet Union has actually reformed and adopted some of the cultural characteristics of the successful Western society, such as free markets, you know, democratic forms of government, no matter how well they are actually applied in practice. And the reason this was because it was clear to people living in the Soviet Union that Soviet Union was losing in competition with the United States, for example. So here we have an example where you don't have hot war, actually, for cultural evolution to occur, but the more general thing, competition between societies, continues to operate.
Right, and I think crucially, I mean, just in terms of, you know, moving past Dawkins, you know, you can see that it's a toggle switch, right? It's not that this thing is always on, that we're always collaborating. You know, we adjust our level of collaboration based on the present circumstances.
That's right. Yeah, so in times of war, in times of existential danger to a group, a typical human group tends to pull together and suppress some of their individual freedoms for the sake of their collective survival. And then, of course, when such external pressure relaxes, then there is a, you know, backwards movement, so there is more capacity for individuals to pursue their own, you know, paths, because the collective survival is no longer, you know, at issue.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why you find this recurring motif throughout history, where leaders are very skeptical of luxury and decadence and peace and too much prosperity, because essentially the group starts to fall apart as people switch much more towards that their self-interest, because there is no perceived threat.
Well, I would say that actually that's not quite right.
Yeah.
Because people can, you know, wealthy societies can still be quite cooperative. I don't believe that wealth by itself corrodes cooperation. What corrodes cooperation is very unequal distribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that inequality is what actually is quite inimical to cooperation. It's quite understandable. Poor people really don't feel like they're the same. Well, let's put it the other way around. Rich people don't feel like they are in the same boat with the poor people. So They don't really feel like they want to cooperate with them, and vice versa. So these types of divisions, they are quite bad for getting cooperation going. So it's not the absolute amount of wealth. It's really the distribution of wealth.
Right. And
go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, you know, we interviewed Dacher Keltner, and his work is specifically on the psychology of power and just how that affects the way that people think. And specifically, there are two things that happen. You know, people with power become much more impulsive and much less empathetic. And in fact, he did a great study that found that people who drive luxury cars are much less likely to stop for pedestrians. So, you know, there becomes this real breakdown in the way that even the members of the group see each other, right? You know, there's a struggle for both sides to empathize with each other. So, but I think that's the thing. Yeah. So, and ultimately this process of collision and competition, whether it takes the form of, you know, providing prosperity or war or trade or whatever it may be, drives cultural evolution. And cultural evolution, I mean, you know, presumably you mean both, you know, new technologies, but also new institutions, new values, new ways of building society.
That's correct. So we can think about institutions as social technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the institutions that make complex societies functional. If you take any of the modern democratic societies like France or United States, we have a whole set of interlocking institutions. So there is the executive branch, the legislative branch, there is judges and cops, the military, and the military actually knows not to try to to start a coup d'etat or anything like that. So there is all kinds of social norms and institutions that interlock together, and only by working together they can make sure that the whole society is quite functional and operates well. So from the point of view of cultural evolution, all those social norms and institutions are cultural traits that evolve, and they become more effective and more complex as you move from the past to the present. So, for example, I'll give you an example from the practice of some ancient states. There is a problem that economists call the principal agent problem. The problem is this, basically. So think about the bureaucrats, right? We have to have bureaucrats in complex societies, because once you get to a state with more than a few million people, it's unavoidable. We all love to hate them, but the truth is we cannot live without them. But the reason we dislike them is because once you give a bureaucrat the power to do things for us, the people, right, they have a temptation to use that power for their own nefarious ends, to enrich themselves or their relatives, friends, and so on and so forth. So the ancient societies encountered this problem thousands of years ago, and they've been trying to find ways to solve this problem. And one of the solutions was that the kings would hire eunuchs. And the reason they preferred eunuchs to people who can reproduce is because eunuchs don't have families. And so the thinking was, okay, at least this guy will steal enough for himself, but he doesn't have all those, children and nephews and so on and so forth who he wants to enrich. And so we will hope that he will steal less than another guy who has to provide for his family. And so this cultural innovation arose actually independently in places like Assyria, in China, and many mm-hmm. others. So by now, of course, we have dispensed this. We don't neuter our bureaucrats anymore.
Though maybe we should.
Different ways to control them. But this is just an example of how things could proceed.
I don't know. I mean, I think if maybe a few more of our senators and congressmen were eunuchs, the country might work a little bit better. They certainly would be more focused on their job and less focused on sleeping with their interns. And even that strategy comes up in other forms too. For example, right, the Ottomans used Janissaries. They would go out and they would get people from essentially what was and is no longer, but was briefly Yugoslavia, or the Baltic states, and, take the most attractive, smartest, strongest children, bring them back to the Ottoman Empire, teach them Turkish and Persian and all those other things, and then essentially make them into soldiers and bureaucrats, but under the proviso that they were not allowed to marry or have families.
Well, actually, they could have families, but by basically recruiting those Christian boys, converting them to Islam, what the Ottomans did, they cut off all those family ties.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that was another way of ensuring that the officers and bureaucrats would not be too rapacious. And then they were allowed to marry and have children, but their children were not actually recruited into the Janissaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another way, kind of ham-fisted way of trying to control this particular problem.
But it's essentially, it is a response to that kin selection. Essentially, you have to, the irony, right, is that in order to get ultra society, you basically have to kill a lot of those impulses that Dawkins is talking about. If you allow people to really look after their immediate family first, then you can't have ultra society.
Exactly. So in small-scale societies, obviously favoring your kin and reciprocal altruism, which is like basically friends, mm-hmm. that works quite well. But once you progress to large-scale complex societies, these cultural elements become detrimental. And they don't have to be completely eliminated, but they have to be subordinated to their higher goals. And so basically, that's why I think that Richard Dawkins' idea about how altruism evolved, which is based, as I mentioned, on kin selection and reciprocal altruism, doesn't work, is because kin selection and reciprocal altruism actually are detrimental to cooperation in large-scale societies. We call them nepotism and cronyism, all right? And so somehow complex societies had to overlay another layer of institutions on top of those nepotism and cronyism to make sure that they could function reasonably well.
Yeah, and there's we interviewed Tamim Ansari, who wrote Destiny Disrupted and Games Without Rules, and he was talking about in Afghanistan, we often see their corruption and, are like, how can these people engage in corruption? And his perspective, the Afghan perspective, is, what sort of monster would get into power and not even help out his own family?
That's right. Well, in fact, it's unethical not to help your family in societies like Afghanistan. And, people who think you're a bad person because you are not, helping your family as you're supposed to.
Right.
So these are all types of hurdles that cultural revolution had to overcome on the way to the outer societies.
Yeah, and in terms of modern American politics, there's a real irony there as well, because, very often you hear the Republicans talking about like how the cornerstone and the strength of American society is the family. But the irony, and part of what, Francis Fukuyama talks about in The Origins of Political Order, Part 1, is the fact that the whole reason why Western society is possible is because the Catholic Church destroyed the extended family. By changing inheritance laws so that, people, instead of leaving their stuff to third cousins or fourth cousins, would leave it to the Catholic Church.
That's right.
And so, I think that's what's fascinating is that it's the weak family that we have in places like the United States and Europe that actually make, modernity possible, that make possible these complex societies that really, generally speaking, function much more for the benefit of all than a place like Afghanistan.
That's right. So let's take another example. We've been talking about the bureaucrats, but all bureaucratic organizations are organized as chains of command. Mm-hmm. And of course, all armies are also organized as chains of command. So initially, when societies started competing against each other, they were very egalitarian. So we know quite well that our ancestors, the foragers, hunter-gatherers, lived in highly egalitarian societies that had no permanent leaders. Mm-hmm. However, when the climate got better during the Holocene, roughly speaking 12,000 years ago, human populations started to increase, and humans spread over most of the habitable parts of the Earth. And as population densities increased, human groups became coming in much greater conflict with each other. So warfare intensified. And basically what cultural evolution was favoring at that time was military organization that would use chain of command. So there's got to be somebody on top who gives orders and everybody follows them.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually very hard for typical foraging populations to accept because of their very fierce egalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
But the logic of warfare was basically unforgiving. If you come as a crowd, you lose to a much better organized, centralized army. And so what happened was centralized societies basically outcompeted the non-centralized societies. All right? But the problem was that there was a side effect. As soon as you give power to people, they will want to use it for their own ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was that when centralized societies evolved, they tended to be extremely, extremely despotic. Essentially, the leaders, the elites, the rulers and elites would oppress the rest of the population because they were giving the power and they started abusing it. All right. So see, you have this again, a non-linear sort of movement in human social evolution, where the pressure for effective competition in a warlike environment actually drives the evolution of hierarchies, which then build very unequal societies around them.
And so, I mean, and the result is that, you know, you need to evolve even more sophisticated forms of cooperation, right? And that's why you start to see the rise of modern capitalism, the rise of modern democracy.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting that this next turn from those highly despotic, very unequal, archaic societies actually occurred not in the last 200 or 300 years, as you might think, mm-hmm. during, let's say, the Age of Enlightenment. In fact, it occurred about 2,500 years ago during the what's known now as the Age.
The Axial Age.
The Axial Age, precisely. Yeah. So the argument goes like this. So as, you know, groups become larger, they the warfare also intensifies. And at some point, even though decentralized but very inegalitarian organization societies begins to be a drag on them. Because, mm-hmm. as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, unequal societies, it is much harder for unequal societies to generate cooperation. And of course, in order to survive in warfare, the more cooperation you have, the better, you know, it is for your society. And so, the inexorable evolutionary logic started selecting those societies which were both centralized, but acquired some institutions which actually reduced inequality. So that's what really happened during the first millennium BC, when warfare intensified even more, and societies had to grow to millions and tens of millions of people, and they basically found that they could not function as archaic, despotic, states. They had to invent institutions that would put restraints on rulers and elites and make them behave in more pro-social, more cooperative ways towards the rest of the population.
Yeah, and I mean, some of those institutions we recognize, like Athenian democracy, but a lot of those institutions we might not recognize. You know, I mean, you have the rise of Buddhism, in India and then spreading around, which, you know, is, again, a more pro-social cooperative mentality that gives us a recognition that we are part of a larger system, or even, you know, Confucianism, right? There's a whole variety of forms that this takes. And I think that in the United States, we obviously narrowly think of that as democracy, but that's not the only one.
Well, and it was not democracy in the sense of procedural democracy that we have. So Athenians were quite unique in this respect. But Athenians were not unique in the respect of this new turn towards greater, the new turn towards less inequality. Mm-hmm. That actually was characterizing the huge swath of territory from Eastern Mediterranean, where Greece is, all the way to China and Persia and North India on the way. And so, and the reason is because all those territories are just south of a huge flat areas which we know as the Great Eurasian Steppe. Mm-hmm. And roughly 3,000 years ago, the dwellers on the steppe invented a new weapon of mass destruction. They learned how to ride horses and shoot arrows from the horseback. And so that was an incredible military technology. So they started using it to both raid and conquer.
Yeah.
So as soon as the Central Asians invented this military technology, they spread to the agrarian societies to the south of them. And by doing that, they introduced much, much more intense forms of warfare. And so what happened was that now we have a much greater selection for cooperation amongst the agrarian societies in order both to survive against the nomads, but also they started adopting the military technology and using it on each other. So as evolutionary pressure has intensified, these societies had to become more cooperative ones. And so they basically were forced to evolve institutions that would put restraints on rulers and elites. So we know some of these examples. You mentioned Athenian democracy. Athenians practiced this very assiduously. They did not want to have tyrants, essentially, so they used recognizably democratic practices to control them. But in other parts of the world, these institutions primarily had, they came from religion. That's why the Axial Age is actually when the world religions were born. Religions like, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and also Confucianism. So all those religions, they share something. They became much more morally concerned, especially with the with the behavior of rulers and elites, the prophets, the Old Testament prophets and renouncers in India and Chinese sages, they all preached against the kings basically being overly rapacious and oppressing the population. So this is the interesting, that the source for this new movement towards greater egalitarian societies actually came from, unexpected direction. It was religion-based source.
Right. And I mean, there you get into what Dawkins would probably hate to hear and does not want to acknowledge, that religion serves a pro-social function.
Exactly. But not all.
Not all.
Because, of course, the pre-axial religions legitimated the, oppressive kings. So it's really, you have to really distinguish what kind of religion. It's the Axial Age religious movements. They are the ones who have played a very, very important role in making human societies much more egalitarian.
Right. And the point is, it's not that we would claim that, the Bronze Axe was, the apogee of, human technological progress, but it's an important step. And in the same way, it's not that the Axial Age religions are the be all and end all of, cultural mindset, but it was certainly a huge step forward.
Yep, exactly.
Right. And so talk to me about God Kings. It really sounds like something out of Frank Herbert and the Dune series.
So what happened was that let's start with egalitarian societies of foragers, right? So they adopt agriculture, let's say, and for a while you don't see any centralized societies arising. It could take actually 3,000-4,000 years of evolution before the agrarian societies, agricultural societies, would start evolving those centralized structures. But once they did, how did that happen? Basically, most likely, in the new situation of intense warfare, people realized that the best way to win the war is to bring more warriors to the battle. And so it would be natural to ally, to create an alliance of several tribes to help you in the battle. And so somebody has to be the leader, alliance leader, and there's going to be some people who would be more professional warriors than others. All right. And so those alliances eventually could have been quite egalitarian. But leaders, even though they could be temporarily appointed to those positions, of course, you give them a lot of power. And so many of them clearly wanted to translate this power, to make this power much more permanent. And a few of them succeeded in doing that. However, they had to struggle against a human side of human nature, which is sometimes known as inequity aversion. So basically, human beings don't like unequal outcomes. And so having somebody bossing everybody around was basically deemed to be unacceptable. And so those new leaders started using religion to help themselves to legitimate their position. So basically, different types of pre-axial religions evolved. Let's just use Hawaiian religion, for example. So the Hawaiian chiefs were thought to control this mana, basically the mana that flows from the gods. And if the chiefs don't use this mana correctly, then the whole society suffers. All right. So basically, I'm, of course, simplifying things very much here. But basically, the point is that by setting themselves up as some semi-supernatural beings, the chiefs actually were able to buttress their power. And so the natural direction was actually to set themselves up as gods. And that's what you see. You see in archaic societies, you see that rulers actually try to claim that they are gods. So, for example, in ancient Egypt, the pharaoh was thought to be the son of God or even God himself.
But, I think that's the funny thing. Obviously, nobody wants to believe that their religion is a religion, right? We all want to believe that what we believe in is just the truth. When you talk about the Hawaiian chiefs claiming that they can channel mana for the benefit of society, I mean, it sounds a lot like what we're hearing from most of our presidential candidates, right? There is this idea that they can sort of harness these mystical forces of the economy and democracy and freedom, and that, we will be able to, if we appoint them as high priests, that, great prosperity will flow throughout the land, our enemies will be vanquished, and we will enter a new golden age, a sort of paradise on earth. Does it feel to you like our religions have changed, but that they are still religions? Is America a religion?
America, it's impossible to become to be elected president in the United States if you're not a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it's kind of interesting. Aaron Oren Zion, for example, in his wonderful book *The Big Gods*, he talks about how atheists are not trusted, not only by believers but also by other atheists. So if you believe in God, then you are become much more trustworthy because, you think, well, if he fears God, this person is likely to be more good than bad. At least everything else being equal. So religion still plays an enormous role, of course, in our societies. And even in more secular societies, such as in Northern Europe, for example, many people have made the argument that the kind of civic religion substitutes Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
They basically believe in the rule of law, into democracy, and things like that. But let's go back to the God kings. So essentially, you might ask, why would people accept? Why would people believe in that religion? I mean, people are quite smart. And they can't tell apart when they're being had, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the problem is that it's actually in those early centralized societies, which were quite violent and quite despotic. So the king had a retinue of warriors who could, at a moment's notice, grab anybody and put them to death. So mm-hmm. in Hawaii, for example, when the English, the Captain Cook's expedition arrived there, they made this observation that when the chief comes by, everybody, all the common people, fall to the ground and don't dare look up. The problem is that if you look up, you don't fall fast enough, you get grabbed and killed immediately. So in a way, that creates a lot of evolutionary pressure on people to internalize these beliefs. So if you really believe that the king has mana and everything, and you will immediately prostrate yourself, and therefore you will survive, leave offspring. So in a way, the situation that was created in those early centralized societies, it was conducive to people basically internalizing their beliefs about the God-given powers of rulers. It was a good survival strategy to believe that.
Right, and the result is that, we've ended up with a psychology, or we already had a psychology that, made believing in those things quite pleasant, presumably, right? I mean, we're incentivized, in the same way that we crave fat, sugar, and salt, in some sense we crave that sense of, spiritual connection, the desire to be part of a larger group, to, belong to some sort of great nation. you know, those impulses are pretty strong in us, and we find it, most of us find it pretty pleasant.
Right, or at least it comes natural. And, mm-hmm. and again, yes, I was again, I was simplifying things, but you're quite right. And what you are describing is essentially known as a gene culture coevolution.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when culture changes so that it becomes, you know, much, it becomes, you have greater biological fitness by adopting some beliefs, right? There is a strong selection to believe sincerely in those types of things. And so the genetic evolution actually is molded here by the cultural environment. And so this is known as a gene culture coevolutions. We actually know that many of the psychological traits have a quite strong genetic component. So for example, psychologists have this trait which is called, respect for authority or authoritarianism, all right? And there is actually quite strong genetic background to this particular trait.
And then, of course, I think one of the big questions is, you know, did these new societies tap into, you know, genetic modalities that existed already in hunter-gatherer times? Or are these things that have co-evolved in the comparatively short amount of time since the rise of truly complex societies?
Yes, I would say that the respect for authority genetic trait must have evolved in the last 10,000 years. And that's quite possible. Human genetic evolution can also be quite rapid.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it, in the environment in which our foraging ancestors lived, the respect for authority could not be, you know, too strong, because you actually didn't want leaders to oppress you,
mm-hmm.
right? And you did not need those leaders, because there was no centralized armies and, you know, other types of organization. So it makes sense to me that that respect for authority actually evolved in the last 10,000 years.
And if you think about people, you know, Genghis Khan and his various warriors, I mean, they succeeded in, you know, spreading their genetic code pretty far and wide.
That's right.
So, I mean, you know, these societies that succeed in, you know, creating these big sort of despotic god kings with these massive militaries were the ones that, you know, spread their genes the farthest. And so it would make sense that a trait like that could end up doing very, very well in the last 10,000 years.
Well, but that's, yeah. Give me just a second. I need to get some water because I'm getting a little bit dry. So give me a minute to do that.
Well, listen, you know, we know that a lot of political power rests on the ability to harness water, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, you're one of the great hydrological miracles of the modern world. And we want you to be able to harness all your intellectual powers, like the pharaoh that you are.
Well, it's not my intellectual power. It's mostly, it's my ability to speak in a reasonably understandable manner.
Well, you know, I mean, both are important. Although, you know, I think that a lot of the god kings made a point to speak in an unintelligible manner. And then, you know, there's a great quote from Henry Kissinger, which he said that, you know, you'd really reach the peak of your career when people not understanding you assumed that it was their fault rather than yours.
Yeah, that's right. But more importantly, those god kings had to have a charisma. So basically, people believe that they are, you know, they would lead them to victory.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you lose too many battles, that destroys your charisma. And that was the end of many of the god kings.
Yeah. 100%. Although, I mean, you know, a lot of these god kings have always done a good job of, you know, I mean, there is also that counter narrative of, you know, they're out to get us, it's a massive conspiracy, you know, they're cheating, whatever it is. You know, god kings have always found a narrative that allows them to survive for a good long time. But I mean, yeah. So I mean, as I read this book, I mean, I think always what I'm looking for is a book that gives me a lot, you know, without necessarily requiring to read 1,000 books. You know, mm-hmm. those books that really draw together just so much research and so many great ideas, and you know, put them in a tight, compelling narrative. And I mean, you've really, really done that with Ultra Society. It's an amazing overview.
Thank you.
Of history, of biology, of evolution, of all the various forces that have been driving human societies up into this day, and it's like very fresh. So thank you so much for writing it, and if you guys want to get it, which I recommend that you do, you should go to amazon.com. You can find it in other places, but I'm a partisan for Amazon. I happen to have that as my preferred book vendor. Surprise. Dr. Turchin, Professor Turchin, Peter, is there anything else that you would really like our listeners to know?
Just to finish up by saying that over the last 10,000 years, the social evolution of human societies has been quite a remarkable trajectory. There has been no linear progression from simpler to more complex societies. In fact, on the way from simple societies like foragers, small-scale societies, to our societies, we went through not one but two great turnarounds. First, our societies became very, very despotic, and you would not want to live in a society like that, unless, of course, you were the despot. Mm-hmm. And then, so that was the first turn from very egalitarian foragers to highly inegalitarian earlier centralized societies. But then there was a second turn, and this second turn actually occurred about 2,500 years ago, when, as a result of the new ideologies spreading through the Eurasia, which we know now as world religions. And so that's when we actually started on the path to large-scale societies, which are much, much more fair, much more equal, and as a result, they are much better at producing good quality of life for all of us eventually.
And so I'm going to ask you a totally unfair question to end with. If you were Harry Seldon, what would you predict would be happening in the next few hundred years?
That's actually unpredictable. But in the next 10 years, we are on a bad trajectory. In fact, I have that prediction published 5 years ago. We are actually right now on a trajectory where inequality is growing, mm-hmm. cooperation is declining, and that spells bad news for our wonderful societies. And basically understanding why this happens is at the core of my research program, and that would allow us, you know, hopefully to avoid the bad things that may, you know, that are awaiting us otherwise.
And what are those bad things? Predict gloom and doom and gloom. Put on your Nassim Nicholas Taleb hat and be our Cassandra.
So basically, the unraveling of cooperation means that our societies become much more dysfunctional. Well, people who live in the United States and follow politics can see that quite clearly. Our political class is much, much less capable of cooperating than 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, it is impossible to predict precisely what forms it will take. But, you know, things like, not passing not increasing the borrowing ceiling, for example, and resulting in the collapse of the dollar. That's one thing. The other thing is essentially Tea Party and other types of people starting to take up arms to fight for their ideals. So in principle, this decline of cooperation and increase of inequality, that's very, very dangerous because historically it has led to much greater social political instability all the way up to civil wars and things like that.
It's the old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. And it seems like we may be about to live in some very interesting times.
Well, I hope we'll actually be able to live not in quite interesting times, because we are hopefully smarter and understand our societies better than historical societies.
Well, that is the hope, but only if we read as widely as you have and read Ultra Society. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Professor Peter Turchin, or as he likes to be called when he's on sabbatical, Peter. His book is Ultra Society, How 10,000 Years of War Made Humans the Greatest Cooperators on Earth. And yes, it's an amazing, amazing overview of a whole lot of science, a whole lot of history. It's the sort of book that we love on The Brian Callen Show, even when Brian Callen isn't here, because he's busy cooperating with all the biggest stars and making television history. Thanks so much. Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.